From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. When's the last time you spoke up, maybe over a divisive political issue? Maybe it was something that would negatively affect your family or community, or maybe it was just over dinner at a really loud restaurant.
I'm sorry this place is like such a zoo.
No, it's fine. I mean, they're fighting, they're mating, and I'm in the zoo with you.
We'll talk about being vocal in a number of ways today. First, though, let's return to a conversation we had yesterday with State Representative Buzz Brockway. He sponsored a bill that would allow students at public colleges and universities to carry tasers and stun guns and other electroshock weapons while they're on campus. The Republican from Lawrenceville explained his very personal reasons for why he's interested in this legislation.
I hope that this is something that can help. Will help everybody, but I hope specifically it helps female students feel like they can protect themselves better. Well, I would let students carry these in dorm rooms and other places where some of these assaults do take place.
Now, how old are your daughters?
My oldest is 17, so she's 17, 15, 11, so she's a junior in high school.
Are you prepared to hand her a taser when she turns 18?
Sure.
Yeah?
Yes.
Here are your first thoughts.
My name is Kit Dobry, and I would say that I am a very liberal Democrat, but I think the idea of having tasers on campus is fantastic, and I fully support it. They are non-lethal weapons, and it would give women a way to protect themselves against sexual assault, which has become such an epidemic problem in academics, and I just think it's a great idea.
Proactive tweets this, I was emotional watching Real Housewives of Potomac last night as the mother and daughter took a self-defense class. I'm taking my senior soon. And another listener thinks it's a much safer option for college campuses. Santos tweets, tasers, the gateway gun. Can Georgia Tech provide self-defense services? Maybe do some research on tasers first, Buzz Brockway. Well, we want to know what you think. As always, you can call us and leave a message like Kate did at 404-500-9457. You can also tweet at OSD Talk or post on Facebook. And remember, we might feature your comments on the show. So how many times have you sat down to dinner with friends or family only to find that you couldn't really hear what you were saying to each other? Take Le Fat. That's a restaurant that offers French-influenced Vietnamese food. Producer Sean Powers was there last night, and he found it wasn't exactly a peaceful atmosphere. Chad Cleary is a manager at Le Fat, and he admits the noise level at the restaurant can be a little overwhelming.
Well, I mean, we definitely have had complaints from guests about the noise level here. There are times when we have larger groups in here, you can't even hear the person that you're sitting across from. So we definitely wanted to do what we could to try to fix it as soon as we could. Essentially, there's going to be certain types of plastic fibered panels that we're installing up in between the ceiling beams to have the sound be able to go through it, reverberate, and come back down to actually absorb some of the level. We've got some already installed that are underneath those right now, and it's just not enough.
Well, Atlanta Magazine recently ranked the loudest lunch and dinner spots in town. Evan Ma is the deputy food editor at Atlanta Magazine. It's good to have you here again.
Thank you for having me.
You know, I wondered what got you on this topic, and I kind of imagined you sitting in a restaurant where it was really loud and thinking, how loud is it in here? But how did it really happen?
I think one of the experiences that sticks out to me was about 2.5 years ago, and I was introducing my family, I guess, to my ex, and this is a big moment. This is an important time. And I picked a restaurant, which may or may not be on this list, and we're sitting at the table, and we can't hear each other. And all we could do was stare at each other. And I just wanted to bury my face in a bowl of soup. Like, it was horrifying. And yeah, that was definitely the start.
And also with us is Vivian Benzik. She's an interior designer and the founder of Square Feet Studio. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Vivian, have you had experiences similar to the one Evan just described?
Over Christmas, yeah, I was with my family, and, you know, you get in a room full of people, and you're trying to talk, and you're having a glass of wine, and everybody, the space is full. You can't hear. And you keep talking louder and louder and louder.
Right, so as you keep talking louder to be heard over everybody else, the people at the table next to you, it just becomes kind of a...
Exactly. Right.
So, Evan, how exactly, you went in to try and measure how loud each restaurant was in order to rank them. Is
absolutely
that right?
It was a little bit creepy, I'd say. I would go up to
it
the
was creepy.
I'd go up to the hostess and I was like, I think my party's over there. And then I would walk into the middle of the dining room and I'd just stand there with my phone and I had an app that was measuring decibel levels. And so that's how I got these readings.
Well, we actually have an example of some different decibel levels just so people can kind of understand what you're talking about here. These are sounds that represent levels ranging from 70 decibels all the way up to 90. Take a listen. Heard a shop vac at 70, a kid screaming at 80, and then a motorcycle is 90 decibels. How loud were some of the restaurants that ended up in your list?
It's painful. It's almost felony level. I mean, the whole point of going to restaurants with people so you can talk. I mean, dining is a communal experience. So what is the point if you can't talk to each other? Especially if you're spending a lot of money. Restaurants aren't free. But I mean, I also understand from a restaurateur perspective, this is it's a great vibe and everyone's having a good time and everyone's drinking. And sure, I get that. But there are limits, I think.
So, Vivian, how did we get here? Because I can remember as a young child, you would go to restaurants and there'd be booths like the difference in office spaces where you had cubicles and now you have all these open offices where it's really loud.
Exactly.
Is that what happened with restaurants as well?
Well, sometimes it's the look and feel that you're after. And Evan and I talked about that. You know, we have these older buildings that we love to work with and you have a young, hip vibe and that's not going to be white tablecloths and, you know, a lot of hard surfaces. And so the sound bounces all around. And we like, at our office, Square Feet Studio, we like to layer in different products, different softer seating. It adds to the comfort. But sometimes the more high-tech products, you work with products that can go in a ceiling, they may get taken out of the budget because
they're expensive.
They're expensive.
Acoustical tile is very expensive.
Exactly. So later, a lot of restaurants layer them back in, like we talked about at the beginning of the show. So, you know, once they get up and running, they can layer these products back in. They're easy to add in. We like to let our clients know, look, let's do it now. Let's get it right now, from the get-go. But there is the option to layer
them in.
There
are cheaper ways to do that, right? I mean, you can put carpet in, although that's an issue.
Yes,
in a place where people are eating food.
Some clients, we worked on a restaurant downtown. The client really wanted carpet. It really helps with the sound. But you have to replace it. You have to clean it, replace it. Carpet tiles really help because you can pop those out. But carpet in the restaurant, cleanability is an issue.
If you're just joining us, my guests are Atlanta Magazine's deputy food editor Evan Ma and Vivian Benzik, the founder of Square Feet Studio. We're talking about loud restaurants. So Evan, when you went to some of these restaurants and discovered, and some of the ones that you include in your piece, really high decibel levels, like you wouldn't, I mean, I feel bad for the people that are working there. That's a loud, sustained noise.
Right.
But were they universally aware of how loud it was?
That's a good question. I don't have an answer for that. I think for some of these restaurants, they're just like, you know what? Everyone's having a good time. People are coming in. We can pay our bills. We're paying ourselves. And that's that.
And you don't hit the higher decibel levels unless the space is, you get it 80-90% full. So at the height of the dinner service, you're going to have that. But it probably, I imagine, it ebbs and flows.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's take a listen to another soundscape recorded by our producer, Sean Powers. This is Dinner Timing at Boccato. Am I pronouncing that right? It's located in Atlanta. This was recorded on a Monday, so it is not those higher decibel levels that you're talking about that you'd get on a Friday, Saturday night. But still. So that's even on a relatively empty Monday night. Now, any radio reporter will tell you that, look, all you have to do is staple a whole bunch of egg cartons to your walls and you're problem solved. But I understand those aren't very pretty. So, I mean, what else can one do? Can you still have that open floor plan that so many people like and maybe put a drapes?
Yes, drapery helps. And, I mean, there are products right now that are acoustical drapery that actually have a noise, you know, the NRC rating.
Sound absorbing.
Yeah, noise reduction coefficient. You can put those in. You can put regular drapery in. You can do in the ceiling, definitely. You can put panels in the ceiling, panels on the wall. You know,
they used to pack ceilings with horsehair. Did you know that?
Ooh, I like that.
In order to absorb. That was back
like a cheap solution.
Like in the 1920s. Well, if you have a lot of horses. But Evan, how does this change? I mean, you're a food editor. How does it change a dining experience that our restaurants in general have simply gotten louder?
I mean, I think at this point for me, it's a pet peeve. And if I go into a restaurant and it's so loud that I can't even taste the food, then what's the point of
going? Wait, so loud you can't even taste the food.
That's an expression my roommate came up with. I can't take credit for that. But I understand what he's saying. It's just, you can't think. Yeah. And at this point, I'm just going to start bringing in rugs with me to put under my table.
Are you being serious about that also?
If the restaurant will let me. But, you know, what I don't want restaurateurs to take away from this is thinking that, oh, it's just old people complaining about the noise. Mm-hmm. Because I wanted to write this story like a year ago. But at some point, I convinced myself that no one cared. But over the course of a year, people were saying, they'd come to me, restaurants are so loud, I can't hear anything. And these people were anywhere from 50 to 60,
And you are
60,
not
70.
Old.
No.
Our radio listeners can't see
I'm not,
you.
I'm yeah. not 30 yet. So
yeah, he's still in his 20s.
He's a lot younger than me.
And I can't hear anything. So if I can't hear anything, you know, I can't imagine how hard it must be for everyone else.
Is there a resistance, Vivian, when you are trying to convince restaurateurs to put in these kind of sound dampening things?
No, there's not a resistance. It's just you go through a process, you know, the design process, schematic design, design development. You do this budgeting phase in there, and that's when they come out.
But we are here in this moment where we're using hard surfaces. There's no more wood paneling and high booths anymore. That's the days of yore, right?
Well, we'll put I love cork on a floor. Cork is wonderful sound absorption, and that comes out, and we keep the concrete. You know, and the concrete is a, you know, I hear that sound from Bocato. That's a concrete floor, I think.
Well, we'd love to hear from listeners out there. Let us know what is the loudest restaurant you've been to and whether or not you, like Evan, the sound is sometimes so loud you can't taste the food. You can tweet us at OST Talk or join the conversation on Facebook. Evan, is the sound quality a significant part of your dining experience for an expert? If you're reviewing a restaurant, do you hold them accountable for how loud it is?
I think even just for a regular consumer, you know, again, going back to what's the point of going to a restaurant if you can't talk to the people that you're going with? I mean, that's half the fun. And maybe all the fun. So absolutely that is taken into consideration when we review a restaurant.
And that's different from a bar situation, a restaurant slash bar?
For sure. And there was another interesting point we made in the story about how people are eating at the bar more. They're integrating the bar into the dining room more. And sure, you're going to get more people, more alcohol. It gets louder.
Okay, and it's also, I'll say one last thing. It's sometimes difficult when somebody's taking your order and they can't hear what you're saying.
Right.
And it becomes a problem. So, Vivian, are we talking tens of thousands of dollars to make a restaurant?
No, not necessarily. No. I mean, you can layer in as you need it. It can end up being that. I think at Atlas, you know, the acoustical plaster definitely is a great product, and we have a project right now. Fingers crossed, it's going to happen. But that, you know, is more expensive than just doing drywall.
Right. But you could just hang curtains everywhere, I guess.
Well, and it happens in the design too. We at Kimball House in Decatur, we did partition. We have a lot of banquettes there, and that space can get loud. The bar is in the space, but we have high banquettes with a lot of tufting. It absorbs it. That's not a high dollar, that, you know, their budget.
So there are options that are not egg crates.
Exactly.
This is Vivian Benzik, founder of Square Feet Studio. Evan Ma is deputy food editor at Atlanta Magazine. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
This is On Second Thought. The Georgia State Senate has passed a bill that allows faith-based groups to refuse service to same-sex couples. Republican State Senator Greg Kirk sponsored that bill. He spoke on the Senate floor Friday. Say that five times fast. Kirk says the measure does not discriminate against non-traditional couples.
We understand and recognize that the law of the land says marriage is between two people. Be it a same-sex couple or a traditional couple, it is neutral. This bill is neutral as far as that is concerned. It is a live and let live bill.
The House has yet to pass the bill and make it a state law with the governor's signature. But the effects are already being felt. One Georgia business says it will leave the state in protest. Joining us now to share the latest update is Aaron Goldscheinen. He's a staff writer for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Hi, Aaron.
Good morning.
I hope you can clarify some of the points of this bill, because it is confusing a lot of people.
It's confusing to a lot of people here still, too.
Okay, so when we say faith-based groups, or when the bill says that, what does that mean?
Essentially, it means any organization that cites religious beliefs in their mission statement, their organizational papers, or say that they operate in a faith-based way, with their faith leading some of their decision-making and how they operate.
Do they have to be nonprofit?
No. The bill's that's part of the rub here that might be coming soon, is that the definition of the organization is pretty broad, and there's not a lot of clarity yet on what exactly that means. Most everyone I've talked to so far believes that a private business that decided suddenly to be faith-based and use those exemptions could probably qualify.
Okay, so one of the original intentions of the Religious Liberty Bill, which has been rolled into this larger bill, was to make sure that pastors were protected from having to marry same-sex couples, which was already the law anyway. How does it then affect pastors in their relationship to marriage ceremonies?
Okay, so we need to step back for just a second, because there's actually three different things here. You've got the Pastor Protection Act, which you mentioned, which was originally this bill, is House Bill 757 when it left the House. The actual Religious Liberty Bill, the so-called Religious Freedom Restoration Act, is a separate piece of legislation that's stuck in the House. So what happened was the House Bill 757 passed the House as just the Pastor Protection Act, which made clear, as you said, that it's already the law, but made clear that no pastor can be forced to perform a wedding ceremony that he or she doesn't want to. And essentially, what it does is guarantee that they can't be sued for it, because, like you said, that's already the state law. When the Senate added the First Amendment Defense Act, they kept the pastor protection language in there. So this is sort of a combination bill of both pastor protection and the First Amendment Defense Act out of the Senate.
Okay.
I'm not sure if that answered your question, but like you said, it's pretty complicated.
It is complicated. So what does it mean when the bill says that the faith-based groups can deny services? What does that deny services mean?
Pretty much what it sounds like. Like if the church runs a shelter, for example, and a gay homeless child comes in for services, they can deny that child services. If a gay couple is looking to adopt, an organization could deny serving that gay couple for adoption. What we don't know exactly is if it could go further, if a private business, using the famous example of a baker who gets asked to make a cake for a gay wedding, if they could deny the service that way too. The other thing that's really important is that it removes any anti-discrimination ordinance that a local city or county has. Like the city of Atlanta has anti-discrimination ordinance for all accommodations in the city. This bill would
override that.
Right.
See, and I wanted to play you this clip from State Senator Elena Parent, because it appears there's also difficulty in understanding whether it's just focused on same-sex couples.
FATA also includes the troubling and unprecedented language that people can be discriminated against based on their sexual habits. This sanctions discrimination against single mothers, people who have had affairs, people who cohabitate, people who are divorced, people who are remarried, and many others.
Is that accurate, Aaron?
Yeah, I don't think there's any doubt that it does not define, it does not make clear who could or could not be refused service. So yes, I do think, and we've reported that it could be interracial couples, it could be, like Senator Parent said, a single mother, an unwed couple who wants a hotel room or wants something else from a business. Anybody that a business owner or a faith-based organization could say that they disagree with their lifestyle based on religious reasons. Yeah.
Okay. A little clarification there. Aaron Goldscheinen is a staff writer for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Aaron, thank you so much.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Several Georgia companies have already spoken out against this bill, including the telecommunications firm 373K. And joining us now is the co-founder of that company, Kelvin Williams. Hi, Kelvin. Kelvin? I guess we'll need to connect with him. We also have here with me in the studio Tom Cunningham of the Metro Chamber of Atlanta, and he put together a report on the potential economic ramifications of these various bills. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
So in this case, we kind of know what could be coming because we can use the example from Indiana, correct?
Yes.
So what kind of things, when you're examining economic ramifications, what does that include?
Pretty much everything. I think the way to kind of divvy it up is to say there are things that we can quantify pretty clearly as serious at-risk numbers.
Like businesses leaving?
No, we can't quantify that. That actually could be very large. The non-quantifiable stuff is easy to identify, but difficult to estimate.
I see.
And those numbers are very, very large and troubling. And it all depends on what the public reaction is. And that is what makes this very difficult. In the case of Indiana, their bill was actually only in place for less than a week. And so we can kind of...
But even within that week's time, there
even
were conventions, that week, canceled.
There were all kinds of horrible things. And we can do estimations off that response. I mean, that's largely what my quantifications focus on, is what happens if we got an Indiana-style reaction. The Atlanta Convention and Visitors Bureau did a similar kind of study, only their question was, what happened if this stayed in place forever? My question is, what happens if it was just the Indiana case? We came up with somewhat similar, well, actually very similar numbers in terms of economic impact on conventions.
Yeah.
And mine goes beyond that to talk about, you know, potential losses in terms of workforce development, corporate locations, sporting events. It just goes on and on.
It almost sounds like you're talking about the known knowns and the known unknowns that Donald Rumsfeld
right.
talked about in a certain way.
That's actually fair.
Let's bring Kelvin in. Kelvin, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Kelvin Williams, are you actually 373K? Are you actually moving to Nevada at this point?
The process for incorporation has already began out there, yes.
Now, will that change if the governor decides not to sign the legislation?
No, for us, it's we're already tainted down here. You know, the state of Georgia is already tainted by the passage of the bill in the Senate. So we don't even want to be a part of it anymore.
Now, this is a major business decision to make. So I just want to delve into why the pros and cons for you. Why would you think that this is a bad business climate that you'd be willing to invest the money to move all the way across the country?
Well, for us, we're in growth mode right now. So I'm having to attract a whole lot of different people in. You know, I want to bring in as many different high-tech, bright minds that I can, and they're not always going to be, you know, they may not be what the typical Georgian wants, you know. If you look at the comments on the AJC, you know, you can see some of that racism and anti-gay stuff just coming out, you know. And these are the people that we bring in may be, you know, Muslim, Buddhist, gay, you know, they could be anything. And I want everybody to feel extremely comfortable coming to work for 373.
Now, this is, Tom, one of the things which I guess is a known unknown, which is the PR impact. In other words, Indiana experienced a loss of conventions. They might have lost some sporting events just because they became known across the country as the state that passed this legislation. Is that one of the things that's unquantifiable, that even if the governor doesn't sign it, we may have done damage?
Yes, and it's huge. The issue is not just conventions and sporting events, but also business relocation. And the overwhelming theme is, why take the risk? That the firms, you know, if you're planning a convention, it's not the group that does it. It is a professional planner, just as, you know, corporations that are relocating engage site consultants. And overwhelmingly, the response on the part of those people is, we're going to spend an awful lot of time and effort in identifying sites, and if one site is going to disqualify themselves, even if they haven't right now, but if that is a potential, why should we spend the time and effort to deal with them when there are so many other sites that are aggressive about trying to attract the institution or the convention?
Tom and Kelvin, let me play you this comment from Senator Kirk, who's a co-sponsor of the bill. He insists that this bill is actually just reflecting the majority opinion of people in Georgia.
And the reason we need this bill in Georgia, there are millions, listen to me, millions more Georgians who hold that marriage is to be between a man and a woman and that marriage is to be between same-sex couples.
So, Calvin, let me put this to you first, because we got this tweet from T-Barf who says, quote, I'm calling BS. Calvin, he says he is an activist and was moving to Las Vegas anyway. This is a publicity move to draw attention to his business. Your response?
Okay. So we just incorporated in Georgia last April, and we have been in build mode ever since. The people who see me on TV, they're not even going to be our customer. That's not the type of business that we're in. We're a carrier's carrier. So our publicity among this is not actually going to benefit us at all. You look at our website and it'll tell you straight up, we don't service retail customers. So it was not a publicity stunt. It was just us saying, we're not going to take this stuff. And, you know, it was a simple tweet. We didn't even expect the response that we've got. So it's been a little crazy.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about the economic implications, possible economic implications of the FADA, it's hard to explain. It's a number of bills combined together that allow faith-based groups to deny services to gay couples that just passed through the Georgia State Senate. It has not passed the House. It has not been signed by Governor Deal. I'm joined right now by Tom Cunningham of the Metro Chamber of Atlanta, who studied the economic impacts. And you just heard the voice of Calvin Williams, who's with the telecommunications firm 373K, and they are moving to Nevada. But let me take this to you, Tom. What do you hear from business interests? I mean, you're obviously very concerned about people relocating, just like Calvin has decided to do. What makes you concerned?
Well, I'm concerned about both employers and employees. And this is a critical thing, too, that Georgia has outperformed the rest of the nation in a fairly serious way for a long time. Our job growth right now is around 3 to 3.5%. U.S. labor force growth is less than 1%. And so if we're going to continue on our current pace, we have to attract workers from the rest of the United States. They can locate anywhere. And as Calvin was saying, you know, if you're in build mode, you really are dependent upon bringing in people from the rest of the U.S. And so for both the employers and the employees, this kind of why take the risk threat or problem is very real, that even existing firms that are here now may not choose to move out, but they may choose to have their expansions in some other location.
Just
we certainly
as
are seeing
Calvin
that in Indiana, for example. Salesforce is, you know, basically they're paying employees that want to move to another state to move, and they're, you know, establishing other, you know, regional headquarters so that they don't have to face this problem again in their home state.
We got a tweet from Robbie Medwed who says a majority of Georgians support non-discrimination laws. That is, in fact, the case. A public opinion in Georgia on same-sex couples and discrimination has turned around significantly over the past 10 years. But let me bring that to you, Calvin, and because although just a majority of Georgians support all of these the non-discrimination and same-sex marriage, for example, when it comes to young people, which I imagine is where you're looking for many of your talent, that that number goes through the roof. Does that also change your calculation?
Well, I mean, I know firsthand, you know, as a gay male, that living within the perimeter that, you know, we're going to be okay right here. But, you know, our stance is also, we're also thinking of the people who live outside the perimeter, you know, 30 minutes outside of Atlanta in any different direction. You're in a different state, it seems. And out there, it's going to be very oppressive. And, you know, like Kirk was saying, you know, millions of Georgians, you know, don't support this. Well, the same could be said, you know, the same was said back in the day about slavery and women's rights. And we need a progressive legislature to help, you know, change the mindset of the rest of the population who doesn't think that non-discrimination is important. You know, that's our stance.
We have about a minute left here, Tom, but what's the bottom line here? Between our known knowns and our known unknowns, how much could we economically lose here in Georgia?
Well, we know that if we get an Indiana-style response, we lose over $1 billion. We lose much more than that if the bill continues to be in place and the reaction is bad. And that's the whole thing, is that it's all about how the reaction is and the in the general public. Social media has changed the way the world works dramatically in that form. The potential for boycotts, the potential for both consumer products and convention boycotts is huge. The problem of, say, the film industry deciding to relocate, the problem of other industries locating their marginal growth outside the state. These are all unknowns, and they're all dependent upon, you know, how this bill is perceived by the rest of the world.
And they all represent a large amount of money.
Yes, they
do. That is economist Tom Cunningham. Since you mentioned Hollywood, we're going to talk about that in a moment. We also spoke with local business owner, for the moment, local business owner Calvin Williams. Calvin and Tom, thank you so much.
It's my pleasure. Thanks.
This is On Second Thought. We've been talking about the possible economic impacts of the First Amendment Defense Act. It was passed by the Georgia State Senate and allows faith-based groups to discriminate against same-sex couples, possibly other people as well. And we spoke briefly about the possible impact should Hollywood stop sending film projects here. And to discuss that even more, we want to bring in Brian Tolleson. We've had Brian on before. He runs an entertainment company called Bark Bark with headquarters in Atlanta. Hi, Brian.
Hi, Celeste. Thanks for having me.
Now, the last time we talked to you, we talked about how booming the film industry is in Georgia, and the governor has talked about this a number of times. Could all of that business be in jeopardy?
You know, I think our governor showed real leadership yesterday when he came out actually during an event focused on celebrating the successes of the film industry and television industry in Georgia. And, you know, he acknowledged that, as you mentioned earlier, that this religious exemption legislation has gotten more complicated and sort of measures have been piled upon measures. And the bill is starting to look a lot like what I think his administration and certainly many businesses in Georgia's would not support.
But to a certain extent, this is an economic decision. Many of the reasons why film companies doing both independent films and studio films come to Georgia have not changed because of this legislation, even if it's signed, correct?
Yes and no. I mean, you know, this governor has led us to be one of the top states as far as the economic climate goes. And, you know, California didn't give up this business willingly. In fact, you know, the stimulation that the assembly created with the tax credits really helped us build an industry. But I do think that could go away because, you know, California is going to weigh its cultural climate against ours. And if we don't stack up and we're not stepping up to, you know, protect our citizens, then, you know, we're going to lose that business.
And when you say protect your citizens, could the possible impact depend on how large the public backlash is? In other words, if some major stars come out and decry this legislation in Georgia, does that make a difference to a film project's decision to base their project here or not?
Absolutely. We're in the business of culture. That's what entertainment is. And if Georgia isn't participating in the larger, culture of our country, and we're sort of stepping back to the days of segregation, nobody's going to stand for that. And I've had celebrities reach out to me and sort of, you know, encourage, you know, the comments that I have made and standing up for the rights of all our citizens.
We're talking about the economic impacts of the First Amendment Defense Act, which has passed by the Georgia State Senate, has not been passed by the House or signed by the governor. And we've been speaking with Brian Tolleson. He runs an entertainment company called Bark Bark. They're headquartered in Atlanta. Brian, thank you so much.
Thank you, Celeste. And thanks to everyone who's focusing on this issue. It means a lot for our state.
We all now wanted to talk about whether or not it's safe to drink the water in Southeast Georgia, or will be. First, though, you can vote early in Georgia's presidential primary. Remember, there is a primary going on right now that goes early voting goes through Friday. And if you have done it so far, we're going to talk about some of the challenges facing voters at their polling places tomorrow. And we'd love to have you join that conversation. If you've ever been turned away at the polls or faced voter discrimination or had trouble voting, tell us what happened. Call us at 404-500-9457 to be part of that discussion. And then join us at 9 a.m. tomorrow for more. Now, as I mentioned, the residents of Wayne County in Southeast Georgia face a big decision. The waste management company Republic Services wants to dump thousands of tons of coal ash in a local landfill. And that could bring millions of dollars into the county, but many are concerned about the ecological problems associated with that coal ash. One of those concerned citizens is Dink Neesmith. He's the president of Community Nervous Newspapers. It's a pleasure to have you. Hi there.
Thank you. Thank you, Celeste.
You live in Southeast Georgia and in Wayne County.
I'm from Wayne County in Southeast Georgia. I own the newspaper there, but I live in Athens, and I'm in Wayne County often. That's where I was born, and that's where my heart always is, wherever I am.
And your concern here is over the effect that the coal ash may have on the groundwater?
Absolutely. They're talking about bringing in 100 rail cars per day of coal ash, toxic coal ash, and it's going into Republic's private landfill. And there is an issue now before the Corps. They want to disrupt wetlands to bring in a major rail spur so they can bring in these 100 rail cars per day of toxic coal ash.
You said an issue before the Corps. You mean the Corps of Engineers?
Yes, the Corps of Engineers. Republic quietly presented an application for a wetlands disturbance to put in this rail spur on January 4. And unless our newspaper had found out about this, it would have gone quietly through the comment period, which ended on February 4. So now the Corps of Engineers has extended it until March 4.
Where is the coal ash coming from?
Well, it could come from all over the country. And many of the power companies that have coal ash stored, they're looking for a place to put it. There's a lot of money, a lot of pressure. And, of course, the EPA has recently determined that coal ash or labeled coal ash is non-hazardous. But ask the people in Flint, Michigan, if lead in their water is non-hazardous to them. Coal ash is loaded with lead, arsenic, beryllium, and mercury and other toxic chemicals.
Let's bring another voice into this discussion. Joining us is the executive director of Satya Riverkeeper, Ashby Worley. Hi, Ashby.
Hi there.
I want to read for both Dink and Ashby the statement from Republic Services. We spoke with a spokesperson there who says the landfill is an environmentally responsible site that has earned a 100% compliance record with the Georgia Environmental Protection Division in the past 5 years. We take great pride in being a good neighbor in Wayne County. Now, Ashby, as I understand it, you actually went on a tour. You've asked questions of Republic Services. Have you been assured that it is, in fact, environmentally safe?
Well, yes, we did take a tour a couple of weeks ago right after we heard the news of their application to bring in or build the rail line that would allow them to bring in up to 10,000 tons of coal ash or solid waste to the facility. We had a good tour there, but, you know, we're still looking into the facility of whether it's capable of handling such a large amount of waste and being able to properly dispose of it and monitor for this type of material.
I want to play a comment from a biologist, Dennis Lemley. He talked with us a few months ago about the dangers of coal ash. Here's what he said.
I've documented multiple times at multiple sites, along with many, many other researchers, that coal ash is a high hazard contaminant with respect to the health of fish and wildlife in the environment, and we have case after case after case to show that.
Ashby, is there a way to dispose of coal ash completely safely so there's no danger to surrounding wildlife or water?
That is a big question. You know, now that we have a lot of this coal ash that is being moved from dangerous places next to rivers, you know, where it's been in unlined ponds for a while, you know, that is the big question. Where does this material go? There is a lot of it out there. There's a lot of it in the southeast that needs to be disposed of properly. So what is the best way? One way that is is proposed is to bring it to these landfills that are permitted and lined, but you know, what is their ability to properly manage all that material and make sure that it's not getting into groundwater or affecting wetlands or wildlife? And so that's a big question that needs to be answered and looked into. I know that it's been proposed that coal ash be used to mix with other concrete materials and things like that, but I don't know enough about the safety of those kind of alternative uses. But one major thing that's being pushed is to move it to these landfills where it's supposedly safer than where it is, but is it truly safe? So.
Actually, the science behind alternative uses for coal ash and other ways to dispose of them is something we've talked about on the show, and you can see it at our website or our SoundCloud page to hear that conversation. But let me bring this back to you, Dink. This is the safer alternative. As Ashby mentioned, for a long period of time, they were just dumping coal ash in ponds.
Right. And of course, for Republic or anyone else to say our landfills don't leak, our line landfills don't leak. Well, the Titanic was not supposed to leak. I'm not supposed to sink, but it's on the bottom. It's on the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean.
So it doesn't reassure you that these are ecologically certified?
Absolutely
and
not. Man-made things do fail, and there was in 2012 a leak that was not reported to the people in Wayne County until we dug it out, but it was reported to the EPD. Wayne Countyans had been at risk since 2012, and they wouldn't have known it unless the newspaper dug it out.
Let's hear once again from biologist Dennis Lemley. He was talking about perhaps the best way to contain ash, even if that method has a drawback.
Well, as far as the ultimate solution is to encapsulate it in concrete, even though it's moved to a lined landfill site, there are still issues, environmental issues, the most basic of which, liners leak, and it's well known that they leak. And we have many sites at lined landfills that have documented leakage into groundwater.
So, Ashby, the whole purpose of your organization is to protect the water, correct?
Yes, groundwater and surface water.
How do you, I mean, when you hear things like that about leaking, possibly leaking lined landfills, can it be possible to put the coal ash in a place where you are assured, you, Ashby Worley, are assured the water is protected?
Well, I think that at this point we don't know. I cannot be assured of that right now. I think that's why we need to keep asking questions to Republic about, you know, if this material were to come in, what type of measures would be taken, what kind of precautions, what type of monitoring, how is the leachate being processed, how can not only Satilla Riverkeeper, but how can the community and the residents that live, you know, within a half mile from the facility, how can everyone be assured that this will not get into groundwater or not, you know, run off of the site or blow off of the transfer area? How can anybody be assured? And that's a question that Republic Services needs to be answering to everyone.
Dink, what power do the residents of Wayne County have at this point to have their voices be heard in this discussion?
Public outcry is the major voice that we have. The Republic has a contract that has been amended some that gives them great latitude, and that's of concern to us. But we have interviewed with our newspaper people that live within a close distance of the landfill. They provide their family drinking water from shallow wells because that's all they can afford. So they're in great risk of this lead and mercury and beryllium and arsenic getting into the water that they drink every day.
You mentioned the Flint water crisis, and that's, of course, where the lead has gotten into the water because they started using a different
right.
public water source. Is this a connection that people in Wayne County are making as well?
Yes, they are. Yes, they are.
And they're worried that their water may become unsafe to drink.
Absolutely. And then we have a lot of wildlife in Wayne County. That's one of our greatest assets is the quality of life in the outdoors, the rivers and the creeks, and they eat a lot of fish. And the water flows down the Penhollowway, which headwaters near this landfill, to the Autumn Hall, which empties into the Atlantic. And, of course, our friends on the Golden Isles that enjoy fish and crab and shrimp and those things, they could very well be tainted with coal ash and those toxic chemicals as well.
Ashby, what is the water system like around and near this landfill? How many waters are within distance of possibly being in danger?
Yeah, this area, particularly here in southeast Georgia, is very low-lying area, so we have a lot of wetlands. There's quite a bit of wetlands in and around the landfill site. Those wetlands drain to the Little Penn Holloway Creek and Penn Holloway Creek, which ultimately goes to the Altamaha River. Also, the groundwater is very shallow in this area. It's very sandy soils, so you do have a an aquifer recharge area that's not too far away, a couple of miles from the site, and there's quite a bit of streams and wetlands all over this area. So the you know, what all is at risk is quite a bit, and we need to make sure that nothing is getting into those water sources, whether it's surface or groundwater.
So Dink, what happens next? As I understand, Republic already has a contract, and they have been certified environmentally safe. So how would the residents disrupt that process if they wanted to do so?
Well, again, public outcry is our major weapon at this point. We're also having attorneys look at the contract, so we think there might be some chinks in that armor in the legal contracts. There is a public hearing the county commissioners are having on March 16.
And Ashby, do you feel as though you have gotten the information that you need of all the questions that you asked of Republic? Do you feel you got honest and forthcoming answers?
I think on some of the, we did get a timely response on a lot of our questions, but again, we keep having more questions, and more questions are coming from the community, which we are asking Republic Services. So I think that conversation is still not over, and we're still not, you know, to some conclusion yet on this facility, is whether it's, you know, capable and ready to take on this type of material and if we trust them to do that. So at this point, we're still in the middle of those conversations and still need some more answers.
Because we weren't able to speak with someone from Republic Services, I just wanted to read the statement they gave us one more time. They say the landfill is an environmentally responsible site that has earned a 100% compliance record with the Georgia Environmental Protection Division in the past 5 years. We take great pride in being a good neighbor in Wayne County. We've been talking about the possibility of dumping coal ash in southeast Georgia in Wayne County, and we've been speaking with Dink Neesmith. He's the president of Community Newspapers, and Ashby Worley is the executive director of Satya Riverkeeper. Thank you both so much.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
And of course, we welcome your voices as well, especially if you live in Wayne County. Reach out to us and tell me if you have concerns or not. That's our show for today, but we also want to get your voices on the so-called Religious Liberty Bill, now called the First Amendment Defense Act. Should it be legal for religious groups to refuse service to someone because of their sexual orientation? And if they do refuse to serve all Georgians, should those groups still get a tax break? Call us at 404-500-9457. You can leave a message there. We're also on Twitter at OST Talk, or find us on Facebook, facebook.com/OnSecondThoughtRadio. For today, that is On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headlee. Have a great day.